Hello, my coffee and research enthusiasts. Welcome back. I'm so excited to have you here. My name is Katie, and today we are talking with Dr. Elias Lambert, who is an incredible human, a just hardworking, all-around talented woman, and who has done so much in the world of bystander intervention. And I can't say enough about how excited I am about what I would say has just such a potential to be really a game changer in the world of understanding bystander interactions, bystander interventions. And I'm excited for you to hear this and for you to learn a little bit more about her, and hopefully do some further reading to learn about the work that she's doing. So enjoy the day, enjoy your coffee, and enjoy this conversation.
I'm excited to be here. So my name is Netta Elias Lambert, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Social Work at Texas Christian University. And my area of research focuses around sexual violence prevention. And specifically, I've been looking at what I would call bystander intervention, or more recently, upstander intervention techniques to help prevent sexual violence at the university level is what I've been focusing on. And so over the past several years, I've expanded into looking more into how we can even take these upstander intervention techniques and look at how we can prevent not only sexual violence, but other types of dangerous behaviors or intolerant behaviors, such as racism, sexism, so other types of injustices. And so I have worked on creating a new program, a bystander upstander, that would actually teach folks, really empower participants to transform from being bystanders to upstanders when they encounter these types of injustices, these types of situations where there is harmful behaviors that are happening, such as sexual violence, racism, sexism. And so the workshop itself is really meant to teach those types of skills. But the neat part about it is that it includes also a train-the-trainer component. So it's a bit more sustainable. So it would just be me presenting the program, but it could also be other folks who learn how to facilitate the program could be teaching it. And it could be a lot more folks who could learn the material and be able to facilitate it in their own universities or their own workspaces or things like that.
Awesome. So naturally, I'm going to ask can you explain bystander and upstander and sort of what those differences are?
Yeah. So a bystander to me would be someone who is present. They're seeing some kind of harmful or dangerous situation occurring, but they're not taking any kind of action to prevent or intervene or interrupt that situation. An upstander, on the other hand, would be someone who is then choosing to take some kind of action to prevent, intervene, or interrupt that situation. So they've seen that situation, they're observing it, but they now have the skills and the knowledge to change the course of that situation.
Okay.
The neat thing, though, about upstander intervention techniques is I think a lot of people immediately jump to this idea of, I have to put myself in this physical harm. I'm going to put myself in the middle of two people that are physically attacking one another. That's not necessarily always the case. So to be an upstander, someone could be even just speaking out. So maybe one example would be someone makes a racist joke. And so opposed to just laughing uncomfortably at the joke, someone could be an upstander by just simply saying, hey, that makes me uncomfortable. So that would be an action an upstander could take. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a physical intervention, a but it could be even just speaking out against intolerant behavior.
Great. Thank you. I think that the distinguishing and sort of talking about how the difference of like what behaviors can look like in those is so important, because I think people so often, like you're saying, they hear the idea and they're like, you're telling me I'm going to have to put myself in harm's way, or I'm going to have to step in, or I'm going to have this horrible confrontation. And that, to your point, there's a spectrum of what that can look like. Is there a way, or maybe part of this is what your program gets at, of like how you also help people feel more comfortable in those situations and kind of what that looks like?
Yes. I think that's one of the, and I mean, research even supports this. One of the biggest challenges to being an upstander is, I mean, in our culture, right, we've been taught that we should really mind our own business, right? If it's not our problem, if we're not a part of it, we shouldn't intervene. We shouldn't become a part of it. But in all reality, in order to change the current norms that exist, we do need to start becoming more engaged when situations are happening that we believe are inappropriate or wrong. And so we do need to start to become more comfortable speaking out things that are wrong are actually happening. And so, yes, the program does provide basically ways to practice those behaviors. So instead of just saying, hey, this is what you should be doing, the research has shown if people can actually try and do it, that's what makes it possible that when they're actually in those situations in the future, they might enact that behavior. So there are some practice scenarios. I think people often get nervous thinking they might do some role plays in the workshops. They don't have to do role plays, but there are some practice scenarios where we'll break out into small groups and think through, you know, what might you do if this situation were to happen? And so we can talk through in small groups, you know, if you found yourself in this situation, what are all the different ways that you might choose to act in this situation? I think another neat thing about, well, I think it's neat, but I think a lot of participants maybe think it's the more challenging piece of upstander intervention. I don't think you can just give someone a handout and say, if this happens, then do this. Because it depends on each individual's identity, each individual's personality, how comfortable each person is, the situation itself, as to what the appropriate intervention might be. And so if you can give as many different kinds of scenarios as possible and give each person an opportunity to say, well, hey, I might do this in that situation. But maybe another team member might say, oh, well, I might do it this way. Both of those interventions might be appropriate, but they might look very different. And so depending on each person and the situation, those would be appropriate, but just different ways of intervening.
Yeah.
And so the idea is just do something. Like, let's take some kind of action and not just stand by and see the thing happening and move on.
Yeah. And it sounds like being able to offer spaces for people to work through it offers the ability to also give that feedback, like you're saying, where people can see that, again, there's not just a single way to respond in these moments. There's just an adjustment to human behavior. I think about it all the time because I was an RA in college and grad school, but specifically in grad school when I did it, we did have to go through like scenario training. It was like one of the last days. It was kind of the thing that everybody was like hyped about and terrified of and whatever, because the way they would do it is if you were new, you had to go through and there were various rooms and like they had taken dorms in the summer and they put the people who were returning RAs or graduate assistants would act out these scenes and you would need to walk in and respond to it. And while it was terrifying to do, and I think the sort of other side of me researcher wise is like, let's take a look at this. The part of me in that moment knew that that was the best training component that happened because sitting in the lecture hall and learning with the 50 other RAs or more was one thing, but when I was faced with a student who was wanting to move out of their room because they were fighting with their roommate and I needed to have, you know, just 5 minutes of responding to them in this environment, it just sort of changed the game in terms of yes. learning. And so I think of that all the time when I think about scenario-based training and just sort of where I would argue learning lacks is that we haven't figured out a really great and safe way, or maybe we have, through these things, right?
Yeah.
Of how to do that better so that people are actually walking away with knowledge gain and not just something that is easily tossed to the side, you know?
Yes, yes. And I have found that one thing that is really helpful from participants, what they've shared is hearing the other participants' perspectives. So the workshop that I do is mainly for faculty and staff, or if I've done it in a workplace, then it's for folks in the workplace. And so hearing their colleagues' perspectives on the situation has been really helpful as well.
Absolutely.
So, you know, faculty will say, well, I didn't think of that in the classroom, but that's a really great point. So if something happens in a classroom, some faculty will say, well, I would talk to that individual student afterwards. And other faculty will say, well, if it happens in the classroom, then you need to address it in the classroom. And they're like, well, I didn't think about that. You know, the other students won't know that you addressed it. So if a student makes, you know, a heterosexist comment in your classroom, all the other students heard that. So if you address it one-on-one, that student, that's good. You've addressed it with that student, but none of the other students in the class know that you addressed that. And so everyone then is going to assume that you were okay with that comment.
Right.
And so it doesn't take me as a facilitator saying, well, you could maybe do that differently. Their peers are saying, hey, what about this other way of doing it?
Absolutely.
And they're hearing it from each other, which I think is really helpful. They hear it differently.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's noting that seems like maybe one part of the answer to this question, but when you're thinking, since your at least initial interest is about preventing sexual violence on campuses, what other ways have you seen this as a program making a change, or sort of what have you seen as kind of the big wins in terms of addressing this in that specific avenue?
Yeah. So I actually did some focus groups with the faculty that have been trained, so that have done the train the trainer, and they actually shared some great feedback around some of the things that they've taken away. And so a lot of the faculty have felt that they have really owned this idea of really being able to change the culture on campus around sexual violence. And so just owning this feeling of that they are a part of that. It's not for students to do. It's not for staff to do. I think a lot of times we see student affairs professionals and students as the folks who are responsible for changing our norms on campus. And as faculty, we are the academics and we're in the classroom. But I think faculty started seeing that they do have a space, a role to play in really changing some of those norms around sexual violence and the prevention of that on campus. I think there were also some ideas around being an ally for students. Mm-hmm. And so students are coming to faculty, especially I know as a social work faculty member, I teach an intimate partner violence prevention course. And so students are coming to me often with outcries around sexual violence. And so, you know, not only being that confident, but then being that ally, connecting students with the right resources and knowing what those resources are on campus, and supporting them in that process. Again, not being their counselor, but being an ally to ensure that they have what they need on campus to get the support that they need.
Yeah.
So I think just in general, this idea of faculty feeling that they do have a space to play in that, preventing sexual violence on campus, and that it's not necessarily for someone else to be doing. And I'm not sure that we've necessarily seen that prior to the last, you know, 5-10 years. I think we used to think that that was for someone else on campus to be worried about. But I do think faculty have a really big space to play in that, and that we have, I guess, a lot of leverage to offer in changing some of those norms on our campus, campus in general.
So in thinking then about this move toward applying it with other injustices, sort of what has that transition been like, I guess? And then maybe what are you seeing as kind of those like initial connections to applying it more broadly?
I think the move has been surprising. I don't know why it was surprising to me, but it has been, but it's been very seamless. I think the more, and maybe it's just aligned with, as a nation, you know, we've been making some transitions I think we should have been making, you know, a long, long time ago. But as we think of intersectionality and we talk more about racism, we become more aware of our role in racism as a nation. I think that these kinds of techniques, you know, if we talk about upstander intervention, it's the same skill set. So you're only having to learn one new skill set that you can now apply across any of these kinds of challenges or behaviors. And so it's, I guess it's seamless in that way that you're not having to teach something new. You're just now teaching a different application of it, I guess.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to, when I think of kind of programming or education, maybe I add some new content, little bit of new knowledge pieces, but the skills and the application look the same. And so that, it really has been a very seamless transition. And as far as participants, they're seeing it very open-minded. They're just like, that makes perfect sense. You know, all of it is coming very easily to participants too.
So when you think about sort of the skills and application part and sort of, and how similar that is, just like, what does that make you think about kind of from the research perspective and just like generally how we deal with social issues?
So yeah, such a big question.
I know. I mean, it's that part of me that's like, are you solving all the world's problems right now?
But it's even interesting because I'm thinking of even as I'm, I know this isn't necessarily what you asked, but I mean, I'm even thinking right now as a, from a measurement perspective, like we're trying to develop some scales that measure, you know, bystander or upstander attitudes and behaviors that go beyond just sexual violence and start looking at, again, racism, sexism, heterosexism, but again, specifically around upstander attitudes and behaviors. And it's very interesting because they do expand very easily in my mind into some of these other behaviors, but then they continue. Like you can add behavior on top of behavior. You know what I mean? So the scales continue to grow. So in a way, you're addressing, yes, many more social issues, but there are so many social issues to address. So yes, you have the same skill set, but the issues are so many that yes, if you learn to apply that skill set in any of those situations, that's wonderful. And I think that's a great thing for people to learn. But then you continue to think, gosh, there's so many injustices that we are dealing with. You know, so yes, does that skill set help? But then it's a little disheartening to think, well, gosh, there are so many of these injustices that we are trying to address, right?
Absolutely. I think to ground us back in reality, I guess, the idea around measurement, and I struggle, I guess, with this a lot around innovation and proof. And where do you, or I guess, how has that measurement journey been? Because in order to keep doing work and in order to keep seeking funding and even, I guess, at the core, I believe it's science.
Mm-hmm.
But then I struggle with applying that to the fact that innovation tends to live outside of those bounds, and trying to fit it in there can sometimes be detrimental to the innovation.
Well, she took the words right out of my mouth.
Throw the table, right? We're done.
Oh my gosh. I'm struggling with that so much. So this program is, it's such a challenge for me because it's so, yes, I think you're exactly right. It's this idea of being innovative versus being evidence-based versus kind of evidence-informed, if you will. And I also think once something has been evaluated in a way, right, so based on these standardized measures and it's been evaluated and shown to be scientifically effective, right? We have shown that this increases bystander or upstander attitudes and behaviors, right? And it's effective. At that point, it becomes challenging to be further innovative with that program. Right. So I'm at a point with the program right now where I'm trying to infuse more intersectionality, as I mentioned, and then more trauma-informed care across the program. So I want that to be something that is, I mention it many times throughout the program, but I want trauma-informed care to be something that we're discussing throughout. So it's just something that is a part of the program, but the facilitator's guide is not there at that point yet. And so once you're right. Once you show it to be fully effective, right, and then you make those changes, you need to do the outcomes evaluation again. And you need to now show that new program to be further effective. And so it does, there is that balance between evaluative effectiveness, right, and innovation and how those go hand in hand. And then again, I'm at a small institution. And I'm more in person, so I don't necessarily have a team. I don't have. And so those challenges also come along with conducting outcomes evaluations. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Where, I guess, preliminarily and without getting too far down that, but like sort of where has measurement landed you in this now, like sort of evaluating this program and stuff?
Yeah.
What are you seeing or...
Yeah. So far, the outcomes for this program have been based on like pre-post tests for participants and then qualitative feedback from participants and then focus groups from the trainers. And so definitely several publications have come out from the program, but it's all been that type of effectiveness evaluations. What I'm working on right now is a publication for that measurement tool that will be the bystander, upstander attitudes and behaviors for the scale that will have more than just the sexual violence, but the racism, sexism. So once we can get that measure validated, which should be this semester, then I can actually do the outcomes evaluation with that scale. So the challenge is this, there's no scale right now that has bystander attitudes and behaviors for those other types of behaviors. It doesn't exist. And so we created that scale and did a survey with it a few semesters ago, and now we're validating that scale. So that's the interesting part of, right? I mean, any of these outcomes of evaluations, if you don't have the measure, you have to create the measure first. One world map. It's very funny. And it's such a unique field. Yeah.
I had someone that I was speaking with the other day who's a community practitioner, runs of various groups, is interested in kind of validating what's happening in these groups. Love that conversation. I'm also always overwhelmed by how do I explain what that journey could be like if nothing exists. And if what you're saying is I want to validate this set of questions I'm using, sort of statistically kind of what that requires and sort of the journey that they're asking to be on in that way. I find it hard to do, but
it's hard. It's challenging, especially for someone who's not who's working in the field.
Yeah.
And for someone who's working in the field and wants to do that kind of as a side project, it's challenging.
Which is also why I struggle, and maybe this is where I personally, or as a social work researcher, need to spend a little bit more time in this side of the work around kind of program evaluation. But I struggle with doing that, with that being useful for communities, right? It's so looking at it and saying, yes, I get it from a factual, scientific, research-based space, and even just like a, when we want to kind of set a standard, I guess, for program evaluation, but I struggle to see sometimes the value in a community practitioner way because it doesn't always give them much. And what's what's the goal? And I think that's similarly where struggling with the innovation versus measurement is like, oftentimes what we say to those programs is your work in order to be funded needs to have proof. But then in order to get that proof, it's like, you know, it's a statistical journey. And,
yes.
You know, one day.
I do know for sure. Yeah, I'm right in that boat right now. It's interesting because TCU is supporting the trademark of the program. So they're hoping to move forward with trademarking the program. So we put in the applications. Yeah, I'm very excited. But then there's also this, I mean, they're not putting pressure. I'm putting pressure on me, right? To then be like, oh my gosh, you know, so you're supporting me with this financial contribution and this kind of go forward and do this. But then there's now this pressure to say, okay, I see that this is making an impact, but scientifically now I think it's time that I show some outcomes.
Yeah.
From this. And so, yes, I think it is interesting to balance that innovation, but I don't feel like the program is ready.
Yeah.
We don't feel like it's ready.
Right.
You know? So that's it. It's so funny. Like, at what point will I go, this is ready for that?
Absolutely.
So,
thinking about that and thinking about this very interesting, very applicable body of work that you have in front of you, when you think about the field, what do you see as gaps in the work that's happening and where maybe not even what you see as yourself filling in, but just generally, if I were to say, like, tell me the five things that you'd love our focus to be on in the coming 10 years, like what would that look like for you?
Yeah. I think, one easy space for me, I do think focuses a bit on what I do, and I think we're moving in that direction. But I think at the university level, I think we need to continue engaging and messaging our faculty and staff. And I think that's something we're just starting to do. And I think we need to continue with that. And so we can't just be sharing these prevention messages with our students. And so really making sure that we're focusing on working with faculty and staff around sexual violence prevention and intervention at the university level. I would say also, if we think of, so when I think of this idea of intersectionality with my program specifically, I have a lot of participants who, when we talk about upstandard intervention techniques based on their individual identity, they will immediately say to me, that particular intervention is not something that I will do, period, no question about it. And so I think it's important that we are continuing to think through just the relationship between different identities and how we are engaging, you know, our criminal justice system, our legal system. I mean, all the systems that we engage with around working with survivors of IPV, sexual violence. And it gets to be more specific, right? For Black and Brown individuals who've experienced sexual violence or IPV, they're not going to reach out to the same systems in the same ways as other folks might. And so I think just making sure that we're really speaking to that and that we're educating service providers and ensuring that those messages are very clear. And so when we talk about intersection, I guess not shying away from those conversations and making sure that anyone engaging with folks from diverse identities is really aware of those intersections. And I think the limitations that our current service providers and our systems have when engaging with folks from diverse identities. I mean, I think it just limits the way those individuals can even reach out for support sometimes. And so that access is just so challenging to begin with. And so I think really having those honest conversations, I think is something we need to continue to work to do. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we need. I feel like those have been two that, oh, and I guess the other one I will say around trauma-informed care. I think that's another one that's been very important for me. I think, you know, we're seeing trauma in so many spaces and ways in our lives now. And, you know, that can be around COVID. That can be around, you know, the snowstorm that we just experienced here in Texas. You know, and it's impacting people's lives in so many ways. So I think just being mindful of how we can have, you know, not just service providers that are trauma-informed, but even how we can create systems and organizations and places of work that are trauma-informed. You know, how we can move to have systems that just function in a space that are trauma-informed so that we understand that people have experienced trauma and that trauma can be defined as just something that has impacted someone's life in a traumatic way. And so how do we then, I guess, live our lives and our work in a way that supports all those individuals. And so not just survivors of IPV, right? But everyone. I think we need to move towards a culture that is just trauma-informed in general. And I know that goes beyond maybe IPV, but I really feel like in the U.S. specifically, we just function in such a way that, you know, it's work, 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 work. And I think we need to start realizing that there's a little bit more to the way that we, to life in general, and how we function. I don't know if I'm expressing that as well as I want to be, but
yeah,
just to be trauma-informed in all that we do.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it even kind of goes to what you're saying about faculty and staff, and I'm going to make a connection that sounds like what I'm pulling from what you're saying. So if I'm inaccurate, I will hear your thoughts. But like, you know, kind of when you're even explaining earlier about how faculty and staff, when you're doing upstander training, kind of how that response is going, what you're seeing from them, that kind of culture change that you mentioned. And then to talk about now sort of gaps continuing to train with faculty and staff. And then talking about the need for sort of trauma-informed society. To me, it's kind of all of this same connector of the importance of people being able to lead, set the stage, see structures in a way that offers more ability for empathy and more ability for just understanding situations that are not rooted only in productivity, kind of like you're talking about.
Yes.
So I think,
yes.
And I would argue that, you know, the hope is that we start moving a little bit out of our silos of thinking and that we're understanding how interconnected some of, like all of the work is, that, you know,
yes,
people don't exist only as a survivor of IPV or only as, you know, a faculty member, right? Like, people are all of these different identities and all those things contribute. At the more that we're able to offer space to the presentation of that those identities, the better able we are to respond and just allow people to exist. And so I think they are lofty gaps in the field that you have noted.
I'm a big picture kind of person.
I hear you. I get it. I'm absolutely.
I think also we are, I think this is to speak to what you just said, as, faculty or leaders even, we should be owning some of those spaces, right? We should be saying we are going to try and fill some of these gaps. So it's not for students. It's for, we should be asking for them to come on this journey with us, but we should be meeting and working to fill some of these spaces.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I do think that's for us to do. And so, yeah.
So
it's hard, but it's big. Yeah.
I think we're already getting at the answer to my next question, which is, if you had just a pot of money for whatever amount, besides, the buying dream vacations and, just like moving us all to an island somewhere wonderful and warm all the time with perfect weather, what would you do with that money that was, addressing something within your work or within?
I mean, I think for me, it's some kind of like massive training event, some kind of training. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, a way that you could engage a large group of people, even small groups across a large space, right? But around not just the bystander upstander program, but around, trauma-informed care and what that looks like, and, upstander intervention and what that looks like, and how do we talk about intersectionality, and how do we bring all these pieces together to have some conversation. But I mean, even from a master's level, even bachelor's level, right? Education has always been so important to me. And so just how do we bring all these pieces of training into social service agencies and into spaces where they would impact clients, right? And they would impact students. And so how do we train folks in understanding these important concepts and then bringing them into the systems that would make change? I think of just law enforcement is the first thing that comes to my mind, but some of the things that we're seeing on the national level right now with law enforcement, if we could do some very specific training, intentional and thoughtful training for our law enforcement professionals, could that have an impact on what we're seeing at the national level? And again, these are big picture ideas, but is that one way to make this change? But who does that, right? There would have to be a lot of money to make something like that happen.
It's an endless pot of money. Right?
Lots of people and lots of money to make something like that happen. And so to me, I feel like if you can get buy-in, and then of course get people educated on the topic, of course, who are willing to do those trainings. Is that one way to change those norms, right? Over time, can that kind of education help impact the norms that are currently exist? I mean, that's my hope. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing these kinds of programs, right?
But sure.
Because, over time, people will understand these messages and pass them along. And then slowly we start shifting the norms that currently exist to ones that are more positive for intervention or trauma-informed care or whatever it is that we're trying to advocate for.
Yeah.
So
I think you expertly guided us here. But, when thinking about the criminal justice response, not directly what you're working on, but sort of when you think about your body of work and think about the outcomes, where do you see the impact for criminal justice response?
So maybe it's not directly what I'm doing, but I think it's all interrelated, right? So if I say to a participant, one of the strategies of upstander intervention is to reach out to an authority figure. That would be law enforcement in many situations. But depending on the individual's identity, they'll say, oh, I, I better call law enforcement. That's not going to be anyone that I'm going to reach out to, right? So from my perspective, if we think of criminal justice, I think of the response that I guess currently exists. I think there continues to need to be a shift in the way that the criminal justice system possibly currently engages in order to have maybe a more positive, more receptive, might be a better way to say that, opportunity for folks to actually reach out and get the support that they might need from that particular system.
Yeah.
And that would be my perspective. Again, I don't do as much work with the criminal justice system, but
sure.
I think from the responses I've heard, that's not the place that people are going to go first. And that's
right.
not who people are reaching out to initially, right? Yeah. And so I do think there's room for further education, further improvement in that system for us to truly provide the support and the services needed for survivors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Wow.
So if people were interested in learning more about your program or learning more about your work, where can they go to find that information?
Yeah, so they can reach out. I mean, I can give you my email address currently. If that is, so it's,
sure.
Yeah, so it's n.eliaslambert. It's eliaslambert@tcu.edu. And we're currently in the process of creating a website for the program.
What will be, like, what's the formal name that you're having? So trademarking
it. It's Bystander to Upstander.
Okay.
Is what it will be.
Okay.
So
keep a lookout for that.
Yes. So it will be something like that. And you will be able to find it, I'm sure, by just searching that. You'll be able to find it. And so we're actually working on it, like, right now. So I'm sure it'll come out pretty soon. And even just by email, you'll be able to find me that way as well. So, yeah.
Well, I really appreciate your time and I appreciate being able to chat with you. This has been really interesting and I'm excited to continue to just watch where your program goes and hopefully, you know, to see its expansion, because I would very much agree with you that just seeing it and seeing us be more enmeshed in this work and training more people around just being comfortable in this space will do lifetimes of good in terms of just our ability to function as a society. So I'm excited and I appreciate you sharing your expertise.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. This was tons of fun, actually. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.